Support for NPR and the following message come from Carvana, on a mission to make car buying more convenient and affordable than ever before. In minutes, you can browse thousands of options under $20,000. Visit Carvana.com or download the app today to get started.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. Next up this week, they might be giants. They're being interviewed by my friend and our correspondent, Jordan Morris. Jordan co-hosts my other show, Jordan Jesse Go. He's also a lifelong TMBG fan. At the heart of They Might Be Giants, there are two Johns, John Flansburgh and John Linnell. The two singer-songwriters have been writing and recording together since 1982. They're in their 40th year. 40. In that time, the band has released 22 albums, won 2 Grammys, and have cultivated a fan base that is passionate, fun-loving, and yes, a little nerdy. They released the first ever download-only record. They ran a hotline where fans could call to hear demos of songs they were working on. Their newest project, Book, is a book, and it's also a record called Book. They Might Be Giants' sound can be a little hard to pinpoint. On some albums, it's abstract and goofy.
Istanbul was Constantinople, now it's Istanbul, now Constantinople. Been a long time gone, Constantinople, now it's Turkish delight on a moonlit night. Every gal in Constantinople lives in Istanbul, now Constantinople. So if you've a date in Constantinople, she'll be waiting in Istanbul. Even
old. And sometimes it's broody, melancholic power pop, like on this song, Anna Ng.
Where the world goes by like the humid air, and it sticks like a broken record. Everything sticks like a broken record. Everything sticks until it goes away, and the truth is we don't know anything.
They Might Be Giants, welcome to Bullseye.
Thank you. Hello. Jordan,
the art book that accompanies your new album, Book, both of which I loved, by the way, both the album and the book of Book are both fantastic. The art book is made up of, it's a lot of things, but it's a lot of photos kind of in and around New York City. And it kind of got me thinking about the New York City that the band started in back in the 80s. I'd like to hear more about kind of that New York, and specifically if you can remember like the first venues you guys played.
Sure. Yeah. Well, we I guess now I always forget. Was it Dr. B's was the first indoor venue that we played?
Dr. B's
in?
Was the first place we played as They Might Be Giants, I guess. Yeah.
Right. And that was in Soho, back when it was a less expensive neighborhood. So there were these little closety sized clubs, because there was another one that we played in around the same time, which was Green something. I'm forgetting.
I'm thinking of Green Street Station, which was
no, that was in Boston.
Yeah.
There was another one that was that had the name. I can't remember. It was had Green. This is before we kind of migrated over to the East Village. We were sort of trying to figure out where we could do our thing, and we'd experimented with getting booked at the Showcase night at CBGB, which was a kind of purgatory. It turned out it seemed like a dream come true at first, and then it ultimately didn't seem like it was enough of a personal scene for us. Or I guess in the fullness of time, we realized like when we started playing in these East Village-y places that it was really a much more friendly and groovy scene for us, that we made friends with the people who frequented those places. We had people other than our own fans coming to see us, and we were playing with a bunch of other, it was actually performance artists in those kinds of places. So the thing with Dr. B's was we just send out invitations and people who we knew came to see us, and nobody else who was there who happened to be in there was particularly interested in what we're doing. And, you know, it just felt a little bit weird and alien, and we were not very confident in what we were doing.
I mean, when I think back on those gigs, I think it was before the idea of pay to play was invented, but these were essentially kind of showcasey places.
Yep, yep.
And I remember we did one show where, as we were loading out, we were the last people in the room for the band that was playing on stage, mm-hmm. and that when we left, there would be no one.
Yeah, typical kind of scene.
Yeah, that felt kind of bad.
Can you remember the time when you knew that They Might Be Giants was going to be like more like a job and less like a hobby or an art project?
Oh, that's an interesting question. We had a bunch of discussions as in the sort of between like 82 and I guess like 88, 89, the band was definitely just kind of like a weekender project for us. I mean, we rehearsed, we shared an apartment for a big chunk of that time, and we rehearsed every night and poured a lot of energy into sort of the abstract idea of the band. But I remember having conversations about how we didn't want this to become our job, you know, that we didn't want to rely on the band to pay the rent because that meant you'd have to do gigs you didn't want to do, which was kind of an interesting, I mean, I don't think we were really thinking about how much success we would need to kind of escape the gravitational pull of, you know, New York City rent.
Obviously, you two are very funny people, and They Might Be Giants is a funny band that uses a lot of like
funny how humor. Jordan, what do you mean funny?
Next question.
Oh boy. But what I was getting at was, I think something that maybe casual listeners don't automatically get is that you know, there's kind of a salty sweet element to They Might Be Giants, where kind of in these kind of
I thought you were going to say there's an unfunny part of They Might Be Giants.
Yeah, well, I think that is what you said, actually.
You know,
I don't disagree.
A little bit, and I think that in a lot of songs there are these kind of serious topics and these like characters who are dealing with some like very, very real and I think a great example of that on the new album is I Can't Remember the Dream.
I can't remember the dream that I had last night, but I woke with delight and excitement. And then when I tried to remember the dream that I had last night, it was gone, but the feeling I had in the dream stayed on. When
I'd love to hear about that kind of this particular song and kind of like some of the emotional stuff that's happening in it, and then just in general, you know, how you kind of go about putting this more serious stuff into, you know, songs where you might not expect it.
Yeah, it's a good question, because I don't know if I would say I necessarily can articulate the process, but just off the top of my head, I think that song and a lot of the songs we write begins with this sort of nugget of an idea, which is encapsulated in the chorus. And it's like a country music, you know, formula where you think of a phrase and then everything else gets wrapped around that.
When I'm awake, I know all that I see and remember it with photographic accuracy. Most of my memories tend to be bad, and I'm sad I can't remember the dream that I had. Why can't I remember it when I can't?
So in this case, it's like, what does that mean? I can't remember the dream, and it's obviously whatever it was, it left me feeling like it's better than my real life. You know, that's the entire concept. And then maybe from that, you can choose to dial up the bleakness of the, you know, the narrative.
So there are some TMBG songs that are kind of these, like formally kind of these like traditional guitar, bass, drum, keys, pop rock songs. But then, you know, there's some that are more experimental. And on this record, there's one I love called I Lost Thursday. And it has all this really kind of unexpected instrumentation and all these kind of unexpected sounds that come in. There's all this like really wild percussion in it that kind of comes out of nowhere, and a kind of robot monster voice that has been very fun to imitate to my cat.
It's supernatural how spaced out we can be. It's supernatural how spaced out we can be.
I'd love to hear about kind of this song and kind of how you decide what's going to be more traditional and what's going to be more experimental.
I mean, I think John and I have, from the very beginning, have done this a bunch of different kind of creative handoff things, not unlike the Postal Service, where we might write, I mean, we've written songs in the same room at various times, but a lot of the collaboration we've done has been kind of long distance. John gave me, I think it was a MIDI file of various keyboard parts, and it had like a, you know, what you might assume is like a verse, chorus, bridge-y structure, but it didn't have like a ton more going on than that, and I spent a long time just trying to find keyboard sounds that would make all the sections kind of stand out from one another. And it's one of those things where I think when you're kind of coming into somebody else's creative output and working as an editor, you can actually see it in a very different way than, I mean, even though like I sang over the track and, you know, put that part of the song together, I think one of the reasons why the song has got so many kind of hard left turns is because I could sort of feel where it could go in terms of the keyboard textures. And one of the nice things about working with computers is like you can really radically change that stuff up. And then the monster voice stuff comes last.
More with They Might Be Giants after the break. Stay with us. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
The Indicator from Planet Money is all in on video games. Not just because they're a fun hobby. Video games are one of the fastest growing businesses worldwide, worth more than the film and music industries combined.
We're seeing some games that are really taking, $500 million to make.
We're taking a week-long look at the video game industry. Listen to the Indicator from Planet Money podcast on NPR.
In this country, more than two local newspapers are closing down each week. As news deserts grow, public radio is a lifeline for staying informed. Keep that service strong with a donation to the NPR network at donate.npr.org. And thank you.
If you've never donated to the NPR network before, that's okay. Public radio is available to everyone for free. But we do rely on listener support from those who are able to give. So join the community of supporters for Public Media Giving Days, coming up on May 1st and 2nd. Please give at donate.npr.org, and thank you.
Welcome back to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. Our guests are They Might Be Giants. The Grammy Award-winning duo of John Flansburgh and John Linnell have just recorded their 23rd album. It's called Book. The album also comes with a 144-page book, also called Book. Book, the book, features original photography from New York photographer Brian Carlson and lyrics from the band. Interviewing They Might Be Giants is Bullseye correspondent Jordan Morris. Let's get back into their conversation.
You two kind of, you work together and separately, and you both still kind of share the songwriting duties in They Might Be Giants. I'd like to hear from Linnell what makes a good Flansburgh song, and from Flansburgh what makes a good Linnell song.
Okay, well, I'll start. I am always bowled over by Flansburgh's lyrical twists and turns, and I think that's the part that, like, I kind of know when he sends me a demo, like when I'm clicking it, I'm like, what's about to happen? And it's usually the lyrics that are the thing that are blowing my mind, I would say. So I think John and I have a similar sensibility with music writing. And there's differences in certain stylistic things, but I wish I could write lyrics like John does. I always feel like that for me is the hardest part, and I don't know what kind of agony he goes through writing lyrics. I don't get to experience his pain the way I experience my own. But I find lyric writing really, really sometimes just it's just like, I'm glad when I'm done, you know, like I'm happy when I've done it. And then, but that's the only pleasure that comes with it. I love writing music, but I kind of hate writing lyrics.
Well, lyrics do seem like they get harder, like the older you get, especially yeah. like it doesn't help writing a lot of lyrics before, you know.
No, I've never been able to do that. I literally never write or very, very rarely write lyrics first.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I mean, like it doesn't help having written songs before to write more songs. Like I see what you're saying.
Maybe, yeah.
I mean, like I feel, you know, sometimes I feel like I fully want to just reclaim like old ideas again, you know, like just say like, okay, I know I've written a song like this before. I mean, maybe, you know, I guess lots of writers get into kind of their mannerist period where they just don't worry about stuff like that. But
sure.
You know, I have to say like, you know, one of the weird things about being in a band for 35 years is a lot of times people ask you like, what the secret for being in a band for 35 years is. And I have to say, I think the fact that John can write a really compelling rock song is actually kind of the secret weapon of They Might Be Giants, because I don't think we would have been able to get through the world as it is if we weren't in some way really a rock band. And that's not having an identity in the world of rock music is kind of hard, and it's also kind of limited. And I think that, you know, really from the jump, like working on songs like, you know, Don't Let's Start and Anna Ang, they're like really guitar-driven songs in a certain way, and it's great. It's really fun to be in like a band where you get handed these, you know, great ideas and great parts, and you can kind of just do it. And it's you know, that I mean, to me, that's kind of the sort of exceptional thing about They Might Be Giants. I think on paper, I don't think people think about like They Might Be Giants, they're a good rockin' band. But you know, just speaking as the guitar player in the band, I think that has been very helpful for us.
Yeah, I think that is a thing that our live audience would probably chime in with, because generally that's kind of the vibe of like, I don't even completely recognize us in the descriptions of our live shows that we hear from the audience, which is they're saying like, yeah, they really rock the place. I'm like, wow, I never even consider rocking a place. Like that's obviously there's somebody is feeling it, but to me it's like, I don't even know how to describe the process exactly, but it's great. It's obviously why people come to see us perform is partly like the actual live event. I guess what it is we're doing the live show over and over again, so I'm just kind of accustomed to that experience, and it doesn't seem that crazy. It seems normal.
I would love to talk a little bit more about the book that accompanies the album book. The photos, the beautiful photos in book are by a photographer named Brian Carlson. I'd like to hear a little bit more about how you got in contact with him and why you thought his work was, you know, something that would accompany your work.
Well, one of the great things about like the last 10 or 15 years of being in They Might Be Giants, so we've been collaborating really head on with this fellow named Paul Serre, who's a very successful graphic designer, graphic artist. And he is really connected to that world of New York designers. And a friend of his is a photographer, I think teaches photography, and knew about Brian's work. Brian actually went to the Pratt Institute in Brooklyn, which is where I went to art school. And so we were looking at different portfolios, and you know, the whole book project was really in collaboration with Paul as the designer, art director of the thing. And as we were talking about it, it sort of dawned on us that it would really be beautiful if we could find one photographer who could just had a big enough scope of work that it could support a whole folio of a book. And Brian's work is that, you know, I mean, it's sort of a strange, it's a strange testament. The whole project is kind of a strange testament to the COVID moment and just long distance collaborations in general. I've still never met Brian, which is super weird. I've like FaceTimed with him, which is, you know, interesting, but it's like, I feel strange talking about him because in some other essential way, I don't even know who he is, but I know his work really well now. And there was something about, I mean, street photography is always kind of interesting. It's a little bit voyeuristic in a way, but you know, if it's done well, it doesn't feel like exploitation. And I think the fact is, like, the truth about They Might Be Giants as, like, you know, the way we approach what we're doing, I think in general, is like there's a lot of unreliable narrators. So, like, there's kind of a real overlap between the impulses of, like, street photography and the impulses in our songs. Like, our songs are kind of they're not first person singular songs. They're not diary entry songs. They're not like about our personal emotional revelations. They're really about characters. Even if we're saying something about ourselves, it's like there's something vaguely theatrical about it. So it's like I don't know. His work seemed to kind of echo something in what we're doing that really made sense. And so, you know, we approached him about doing it, and you know, and he was very into it. So the whole thing has been kind of a glorious love fest.
Miracle.
In next year, in 2022, you guys have a tour planned after some time of not being on tour. And I guess a part of this tour is you are going to play, I think, the entirety of your 1990 album, Flood.
Well, it was this weird thing happened, which is that there was an interval of time when we were planning this tour where we were actually between albums. It was, we had not finished the album that is coming out right now, but we were going to go back out on the road. So we were just thinking, like, well, what can we do if we're not touring behind a new album? And we thought, oh, well, it's the 30th anniversary of Flood, and we'll just celebrate that, and that'll be a huge crowd pleaser anyway, so we'll just try that out. And of course, it was like a huge success. I mean, we've really avoided a lot of the sort of low-hanging fruit of being like a nostalgia, whatever you call it, like a legacy act, I guess is the term that people call it. But people have been doing this thing. We play full albums a lot of times when we're playing a second night in some city. So we've done lots of Flood shows before. And we even have done it in various different ways. We've done it like in reverse order. We've done it mixed into a set. But that was for 2020, and it's been rescheduled three times now. So we're just rolling with the changes, man.
What is it about Flood that you think makes it so special to people? Because I think it is a very special album to a lot of people.
We've had to kind of consider this because obviously we like all our records, and I feel much closer to the stuff we've done in the last 30 years. but there is obviously something about Flood that really connected with people. And I think at that time, what it seemed like was that we had fully, you know, we had two indie albums up until that point, and we'd really kind of established what it is we were doing. And it was a kind of a more fleshed out, kind of high, I mean, I hate to say this, but kind of a high end version of this indie thing that we've been doing. And we had this monster corporation promoting us for the first time. We were signed to Warner Elektra. And so we had all this international distribution and, you know, just this giant machine of a record company to promote this thing. So, you know, it was this confluence of everything. I think, and I hate to say this, but there is a thing about bands when they're starting out where they often have a kind of an initial explosion of creativity that it sort of ramps up, in our case, to the third album. There was a kind of a third album sort of focusing of everything that we were doing. you know, we knew exactly what we wanted to do. So in that sense, yeah, it was kind of this lucky confluence. And like I said, if I look at everything we've done up until now, it's, to me, it's the work of like a much more juvenile couple of guys. So it's I can't completely identify with that album like the way I do with the last, maybe the last 10 years in particular, the stuff we've been doing, or I would say the last 20 years in a way, I feel like very much closer to that stuff. You know, we've obviously had we've lived a long time since we came out with Flood. But I remember the excitement of that time as well. And this sort of partly the excitement of having all this all these resources that we hadn't fully had up until then. We were able to record in a fancier studio and we weren't kind of cutting corners the way we had been doing economically up until then.
We've got so much more to get into with They Might Be Giants. We kicked off the interview with a classic from the band, Anna Ng. When we come back from the break, have They Might Be Giants heard the crust punk ska version of that hit song? Well, we're going to play it for them. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Across America, history is often recorded on small markers. You've probably seen them on the sides of roads, in front of buildings, in the middle of nowhere. NPR's Laura Sullivan spent a year investigating thousands of markers and found a distorted version of America's history, but also curiosities, humor, and joy. Listen to the new episode of The Sunday Story on the Up First podcast from NPR.
Over the past couple decades, the U.S. has lost about a third of its newspapers, taking thousands of local journalists off their beat. A functioning democracy and functioning local journalism go hand in hand. We're trying to do our part, and that's why we need you to do your part. Make sure that the NPR network stays strong by supporting us at donate.npr.org. And thank you.
We've all made mistakes in book club, right? You drink a little too much, you don't actually read the book. And if you're under the bubble in Fairhaven, your individual will gets subsumed by the collective.
Hey, maybe I just let him go and whip us up some guac.
We do not require guac. We require only nutrients and expansion. You will become book club. You will eat, pray, and love with us. Join book club.
Bubble, the sci-fi comedy from MaximumFun.org. Just open your podcast app and search for Bubble.
This is Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. You're listening to Jordan Morris's conversation with John Flansburgh and John Linnell, the co-founders and frontmen of the band They Might Be Giants.
I was also really excited to read that this tour is going to feature some selections from They Might Be Giants album that I love called Mink Car.
Oh, that's nice. Thank you.
And it's described on the website as a lost album, and I had no idea that it had this history. I'd love to hear about what you're excited about playing off Mink Car and how it became a lost album. I just didn't know that.
We're right. Excited about knowing how to play the songs that we're going to play off of Mink Car, so that we're going to pick those probably. But the only reason that Mink Car is, you know, became lost was because it was released on 9/11, which you know, a lot of records are released actually on 9/11. There's only two big days a month that records are released, and 9/11 happened to be the first month, the first day in September that records were released. But what happened was the very newly minted record label that we were on immediately lost their funding. So it became, you know, they were out of business in less than 2 months after the record came out. So it just was not available at all for a long interval of time and, you know, wouldn't even come out on iTunes because there was kind of like a rights knot surrounding it. But what's weird is that it, in many ways, it was kind of designed to be this, you know, pop juggernaut. We worked with, you know, Adam Schlesinger from Fountains of Wayne on it. We worked with Clive Langer and Alan Stanley, the producers we worked on Flood with. So it was like a reunion of that. And it's, you know, it's got a lot of, you know, big peak moments. Like, it's a very pop kind of front loaded album. But it just inadvertently kind of, you know, fell to this other historic event.
Yeah, something about Mink Car that I like so much is that there are these kind of like...
It's a psycho album. I mean, it's crazy.
It's nuts. It's nuts. It's so cool, though. It's like such
a fun... You chimed in very quickly there.
Yeah.
Yes, it's great. It's insane.
Well, it's like, I mean, I have listened to it recently, and it's like there's... It doesn't flow from like one kind of song into another like kind of song ever, you know. So it's like, here's the electronica song, here's the super loud rock song, here's the really quiet kind of, you know, percussive ballady song. It's a real we're just kind of, you know, bouncing off the guardrails of the musical highway.
Yeah, I'd love to hear about what's fun about kind of experimenting with those other genres, because I think that there is some stuff on that is not, you know, there's dance pop, there's kind of like lounge music, there's some
right.
Like,
well, yeah, I mean, I suppose some of it was in fact driven by the producers that we work with, and we, you know, mostly wanted to do our own mental illness, you know, on our, you know, just like draw from our own completely not so ideas, it really, we experienced this completely other flavor with, you know, Adam Schlesinger had all sorts of, you know, I think he saw this as like an opportunity, like, because we were perfectly comfortable hanging out with him by the time of this recording. And so he could say, well, let's take this song and make it into this completely other thing.
And, right. You know, like a song like Another First Kiss is like a kind of an interesting example of like Adam really having at it. Like, you know, we had recorded a live version of the song that's essentially just our kind of regular power pop way of approaching a song. And it, you know, to us, it's like, oh, that's kind of like, that's what a pop song is, you know, that's, and, you know, he's in a kind of power pop band himself. So I thought you would think he would just be like, you know, good job. But instead he was like, he actually was like, you know, you could make this a much more interesting, you know, kind of like a ballad song. And it was just like, oh, okay.
Other people were too sentimental and always worrying about their hair. Got tired of wasting all my time. Now I'm not worrying at all. How about another?
And, you know, similarly with Man Is So Loud In Here, you know, Adam just had this whole other take on it, which was to really take, you know, the idea that's inside the lyric of the song, which is about being kind of inside a really oppressive disco area, and then turn that into like the actual music. I mean, it's sort of meta. It's like, that's the music that the song is made of, is the get out disco, you know, sound. And I think it's pretty effective, but it's like, it was definitely seemed like a hard left turn.
Yeah, when I would say with those two songs, he was pulling out something that we wouldn't have tried to do and maybe have been able to do on our own. So we were really, this is like the actual value of getting another person in to produce. It's like he came up with some truly different stuff. And Clive and Alan, who we'd worked with already, I think mainly they wanted to just do the thing they'd done on Flood, which is to bring out, you know, accentuate the stuff they thought was cool. So I mean, I specifically remember this with doing vocals with them on Mink Car, was that they were more demanding of us than we probably would ordinarily have been. We were the normal amount of demanding with ourselves, and then they were adding on to that by going, well, it could be better, you know, like, do try this again, only more good, you know. So that I remember all that process pretty well, because we worked with him in London, right?
Yeah.
And then we were working with Adam in New York, and it was a multi, you know, it was like a multi-studio project.
Well, I mean, just circling back to the whole thing of, like, you know, working with Clive and Alan in the first place. Like, Clive and Alan were these big hitmaker guys. They did, like, Madness and the Dexiest Midnight Runners, Come on, Eileen, which was kind of like the first unplugged kind of recording. And they did Morrissey albums. And I'm trying to think. Oh, they did Dancing in the Streets with Mick Jagger and David Bowie. And they had tons of hits. They were literally the biggest producers of the year, the first year we worked with them. And the record company was very into the idea of us getting together with them for obvious reasons. But what was so great is, like, how generous they were with, like, all the sort of trade secrets of how to make recordings, because, you know, we had only worked in 8-track studios before then, and that was, and suddenly we're in these, like, enormous rooms with all this stuff, and they really welcomed us as peers, which we certainly weren't in some ultimate way. but like, they, you know, I just felt like we were in this crazy 2-month-long masterclass in how to make great sounding records. And it was fantastic.
Have you guys heard the crust punk version of Anna Ng?
No,
I don't think so. No,
no, it's really good. It really works. It totally works.
What, you have to back up just a little bit for the old guys here. Like, what is crust punk?
The band is called Star F***ing Hipsters. They are good. Like a fat,
I'm looking forward to hearing that on the radio.
Fat, yeah. Records band. And it's got a lot of, like, guttural metal screaming, and it totally f***ing works. It's
cool.
Really good.
Make a hole with a gun perpendicular to the name of this town in a desktop blow. Exit going in a foreign nation, showing the home of the one this was written for. My apartment looks upside down from there. What is crime was the wrong way out the sink, and a voice is a bad.
Anyway, you get it. You get it.
Yeah,
my point
yeah.
is that it works. They Might Be Giants rocks. Anyway.
Lovely. Yeah, yeah.
They Might Be Giants. Thanks for hanging out with us on Bullseye.
Thank you, Jordan.
Thanks for having us.
They Might Be Giants. Their newest project, Book, drops November 12th. You can get it on their website right now. We'll have a link to it on the Bullseye page at MaximumFun.org. Thanks to Jordan Morris for conducting the interview. Jordan is also the co-host of my comedy podcast and his, Jordan Jesse Go. Jordan is a comedy writer and an author. His latest book is a graphic novel called Bubble. It's a science fiction comedy where people get paid through an app to hunt monsters. It is funny, weird, and very brilliant, in my opinion. Not biased. If you have a sci-fi fan or a comedy fan in your family, consider your holiday shopping over. That's the end of another episode of Bullseye. Bullseye is created from the homes of me and the staff of Maximum Fun in and around Greater Los Angeles, California. In my neighborhood, many houses have dragon fruit plants trellised across their front yard. They are these extraordinary, long, cactusy things, and they grow the incredible, almost science fiction, fantasy-ish dragon fruits on them, and those dragon fruits are starting to turn red and come ripe, and I'm hoping I can scam a few from a neighbor. Maybe they want some of the grapefruits that grow in my backyard. Our show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our senior producer is Kevin Ferguson. Our producer is Jesus Ambrosio. Production fellows at Maximum Fun are Richard Roby and Valerie Moffitt. We get help from Casey O'Brien. Our interstitial music is by Dan Wally, also known as DJW. Our theme song is called Huddle Formation. It's recorded by the group The Go Team. Thanks to them and to their label Memphis Industries for sharing it with us. You can also keep up with our show on Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube. We post our interviews in all those places. And I think that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
The Indicator from Planet Money is a daily podcast that helps you make sense of what's happening in the economy. And video games are a growing slice of that economy, with billions of people around the world identifying as gamers. That's why we're dedicating a week-long series to the growing business of video games. Listen to the Indicator from Planet Money podcast on NPR.
There are a lot of issues on voters' minds right now. Six big ones could help decide the election. Guns, reproductive rights, immigration, the economy, healthcare, and the wars overseas. On the Consider This podcast from NPR, we will unpack the debates on these issues and what's at stake. You can listen to NPR's Consider This wherever you get your podcasts.
On the Code Switch podcast, conversations about race don't start and stop with the news cycle. We know that race is always relevant, and we have new topics, new voices, and new stories for you every single week. Listen to the Code Switch podcast from NPR.